The former president of the Philippines earned a nickname, the Punisher. His approach for suspected drug dealers was brutal.
For every death, there would be a value, and money would be given to the one who pulled the trigger.
Now Rodrigo Duterte is locked up, awaiting trial at the International Criminal Court. I'm Marco Werman. More on Duterte's arrest and the International Olympic Committee's new president,
Mrs. Kirsty Coventry.
She's breaking many barriers. Also, an update on the new Israeli military offensive in Gaza. And everyone remembers where they were 5 years ago when the pandemic began.
News comes out about COVID, everybody leaves. I'm the only person left in a four-story guest house.
All those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in to us today. We begin in The Hague, where 79-year-old Rodrigo Duterte is confined to a drab prison cell. From 2016 to 2022, Duterte was the president of the Philippines. He seemed invincible, but last week he was arrested on a warrant issued by the International Criminal Court for carrying out a so-called war on drugs that killed, by some estimates, up to 30,000 people. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports that victims' relatives are now ready to face Duterte in court.
It's hard to single out the most outrageous thing Rodrigo Duterte ever said into a microphone. But this is up there.
My campaign against drug will not stop until the last pusher and the last drug lord are...
A bloody purge of meth users and dealers. This was his core campaign promise. And to many Filipinos fed up with disorder, it sounded good. Some thought, sure, he's vulgar and you can't take him literally, but maybe the Philippines needs a leader who's tough.
My parents and aunts and uncles, basically the entire family, voted for Duterte.
Shira Escudero was in college at the time, in 2016. She's from a working-class neighborhood in San Pedro, a factory town south of Manila. Escudero never liked Duterte, and her fears were vindicated when the drug war kicked off. Dead men started showing up on street corners, often with a gruesome flourish, brown packing tape wrapped around their heads like mummies.
My victims, I would like to be all criminals to finish the problem of my country and save the next generation.
Escudero's parents worried about drugs because their son, Efrem, he'd had a wild streak at 15, where he'd dabbled with drugs. Fortunately, that was all behind him. At 18, Efrem was a young father with two sons, flying right, working hard at the family business, a mobile phone repair shop.
He showed how responsible he is. Like, from a playful teenager, he became a really good provider.
One night in September 2017, Efrem left his parents' house, where he lived, and headed out on his red Suzuki motorbike. He was going to finish some work at the shop, then zip back home in time for dinner. He didn't return. Very unusual. The next day, Escudero came home from class and saw her family making posters that said, missing person.
My hands went cold. I was shaking. It was so hard to breathe, knowing that maybe something really bad happened to Efrem.
It took 5 days to track him down. Efrem was murdered. His body left on a random street corner, 75 miles away.
He was found with packaging tape around his head, dumped on a patch of grass, his face down underground, his hands bound with packaging tape.
The police showed no interest in finding Efrem's killer, so Escudero and other survivors turned to the International Criminal Courts. Attorney Cristina Conti is an assistant to counsel with the ICC, helping investigate the drug war killings.
There's so many things that we could consider because there weren't any witnesses to the killing of Efrem.
Her investigation has found that police made lists filled with names of suspected drug buyers. Conti says police and associated gunmen were paid cash to kill people on these lists.
For every death, there would be a value and money would be given to the one who pulled the trigger, to the others who were part of the team, to the chief of police, and so on.
The price for taking out a so-called drug user was often just a couple hundred bucks. Conti says this was organized mass murder.
The government, specifically Duterte, made sure to emphasize that the numbers do matter, and the more the merrier.
It has to be said, Duterte was a popular president, even as bodies piled up.
In the midst of poverty, in the midst of almost insurmountable problems, the people here, we being Catholic or Christian in general, have been looking for a messiah, someone who would pull us out of our misery.
Efrem's death shattered the family. Shira Escudero says she struggles with her mental health. She's now a virtual medical assistant for an American company working in the dead of night, Philippines time. She often thinks about the sheer number of people it took to execute this drug war. Many are still in uniform, like it never happened.
It fueled me even more to keep on speaking, saying, hey, we're real people. Look at us, please. Those people who were killed, they have families, they have children, and now they're orphans.
Duterte is a prosecutor's dream. He said over and over, even in front of the Philippine Congress recently, he takes full responsibility for the drug war.
And if I am found guilty, I will go to prison and rot there for all time.
Escudero wants to tell her brother's story in court to Duterte's face. She hopes his downfall gives pause to other authoritarian leaders.
This issue is something bigger than me, than Efrem, than the Philippines. As long as there's a tyrant leader, bloodthirsty law enforcers, this could happen in other countries as well.
For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
The International Olympic Committee is in charge of all things related to the Games, and the person at the helm of the organization, the president, is known as the most powerful person in the sports world. Today, IOC members elected a new president.
Mrs. Kirsty Coventry.
That was current President Thomas Bach announcing the new IOC head. Kirsty Coventry is from Zimbabwe. Members of the IOC cast their votes in Greece, about 60 miles south of Olympia, the birthplace of the ancient games. The world's Bianca Hillier is in our Boston studio with the details. So, Bianca, Kirsty Coventry, what do we know about the new president-elect of the IOC?
Coventry knows the Olympics really well because she herself is a five-time Olympic swimmer. She had an epic streak in the early 2000s and became Zimbabwe's most decorated Olympian, having won seven of the country's eight medals to date. For the past 6 years, though, she's served as Zimbabwe's sports minister. So that's mainly where she's earned a lot of her chops as a sports administrator that's going to help her here as president. This win is really big news for the IOC. She's a very unique president for the organization.
Right. Unique in what way?
Well, she's the first in a lot of ways. First woman to lead the IOC, first person from Africa, and at 41 years old, she's also the youngest ever president. And this diversity, Marco, is something that a lot of people have said the IOC badly needs. So it's going to be interesting to see how her presidency changes the organization.
Right. I know you'll be following that. Have we heard from Kirsty Coventry since she won the IOC presidency?
Yes, she made a statement today after the announcement, and she said winning the election felt like winning her first Olympic medal back in 2004, which also happened to be in Greece. And she said it's a powerful signal to have a woman and an African at the head of the IOC.
It's a signal that we're truly global, and that we have evolved into an organization that is truly open to diversity. And we're going to continue walking that road in the next 8 years.
Powerful statement. And as you said, a big change for the IOC. Was Coventry expected to win today?
She was, but not really in this way. The outgoing IOC president, Thomas Bach, had reportedly been lobbying for her behind the scenes, and IOC voting members have generally liked Bach, so his opinion would have held a lot of weight with them. But there were a number of other frontrunners in this race that also had a lot of buzz around them, so many people expected this voting to have to go through several rounds to get a majority. But there was just one round. Actually, Coventry got the majority of the votes right away, and that really surprised people.
Huh, that's interesting. What do we know about how Coventry wants to run the IOC? I mean, it's an organization that's known to have bumped into controversy.
That's right. And the campaign process itself is controversial. It's pretty secretive. It's actually compared to a conclave, you know, the behind closed doors process of cardinals selecting a new pope. But in January, Coventry did say that she would push for more investment in African athletes. A lot of people are hoping that she'll bring the Olympics to Africa for the first time. And another topic she'll have a big say in is including trans athletes in sports. She hasn't come right out and said her position on this yet, but she has said she thinks the IOC should drive the decision instead of leaving it up to the governing body of each sport.
I believe we need to do that with leadership in collaboration with the international federations, but it should be one collective, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to handle it.
Got it. So, Bianca, you likened this election process earlier to a papal conclave. I mean, how big of a deal is this?
It really is a big deal. There have actually been even fewer IOC presidents than popes since 1894, when the IOC was formed. Huh. So this is a super rare moment for the IOC to get a new leader. And Coventry will officially become president in June. At that point, she'll be presiding over an organization that brings in revenues of over $7 billion per four-year cycle.
Wow. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for the show. Thank you, Bianca.
Hey, thanks, Marco.
Earlier this week, tragedy struck in Honduras.
12 people who were killed after a small plane crashed off the Caribbean coast on Monday. Now, Honduran officials say the jet stream departed from an airport on Roatan Island, and that's about 35 miles from the Honduran mainland. And
that's a report from CBS. On board that plane was the Honduran musician Aurelio Martinez, a culture activist for the Garifuna people in Central America and an innovative artist himself. We featured Aurelio Martinez several times on the show. In 2002, I met him in Belize and spoke with him for a story I was working on about Garifuna music and where it came from. The story of the Garifuna people is about a group of enslaved West Africans who tried to revolt against the British in the 18th century on the Caribbean island of St. Vincent. The authorities deported them afterwards to the previously mentioned Roatan Island. Illness killed half the population, leaving 2,500 black Caribs to settle along the coast of what now comprises Honduras and Belize. They developed their own language and artistic culture. Today, the Garifuna population on that coast is about 500,000. Its language, dance, and music were actually inscribed as UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage in 2008, although even the UN admitted at the time how economic migration, discrimination, and the complete absence of the Garifuna language from the school system are endangering its survival. When Aurelio Martinez last spoke with me in our Boston studio in 2014, he talked about his fight to keep the culture alive after the death of two of his fellow Garifuna icons, Andy Palacio and Paul Nabor.
Well, music is something special for in our community. You know, I'm trying to do my best to keep alive our culture. But, you know, we have many things happen to kill this culture. But I am the one of the soldiers who to keep alive our culture. You know, Andy Palacio passed away. He's one, you know, Paul Nabor. And now we have many, many young people trying to do something.
Aurelio's modesty may not have allowed it, but he was a leader to those young people waging that fight to save Garifuna culture. His death now leaves them with a heavy duty, along with shock and sadness for his many fans around the world. Aurelio Martinez was 55.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. I've spent the past 4 years investigating a crime.
When you're driving down this road, all right, plan on killing somebody.
A four-year investigation, hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
Did you think that a war crime had been committed?
I don't have any opinion on that.
Season 3 of In the Dark is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the Baltic nation of Latvia, there's the village of Mūcinieki, population around 600. Picture Soviet-era apartment blocks, a bus stop, and a food store, and one of Latvia's two reception centers for migrants. In the past 3.5 years, EU countries that border Belarus, including Latvia, have intercepted thousands of people trying to get to Europe. Since 2021, Latvian border guards have been operating under orders to use physical force to prevent those crossings. This man is an Afghan migrant who says he's been on the receiving end of those orders.
When we stop it, they hurt us a lot and they take us to the road. And they told us to lay down and they step out their foot in our neck and hurt us a lot.
The Afghan man did not want to share his name, but he spoke with reporter Ben Badke with our partner Deutsche Welle. They met on a soccer field near the migrant reception center in Mūcinieki. The man says border guards physically abuse migrants to prevent them from coming to Latvia. He says he was beaten with batons and then driven to a border fence in a forest.
They take our phones also. We cannot send location for someone, for a gent, those guys that help us to come here. We was lucky that we found one Pakistani guy in the forest and he has the phone and he helped us. He was from other regions. I was thinking that maybe I will die in this forest.
While it's impossible to independently verify his claims, the man showed the scars from his wounds, and his allegations track with details that Amnesty International and other groups have documented. Reporter Ben Badke picks up the story from here.
To find out how the border guard reacts to these accusations, I drive the 3 hours from Riga to the border with Belarus. I have an appointment with Vladimir Scherst of Latvia's border guard force. Together with the Latvian-Russian border, the unit is responsible for roughly 450 kilometers of the EU external border. After a bumpy ride from the border guard station to the border with Belarus, I ask Scherz what happens when they detect an unauthorized border crossing.
First of all, border guard evaluate this person. If this person needs medical assistance or any other kind of support, like clothes, food, water. If nothing is needed, this person is prevented from the illegal border crossing and sending back to the territory of Belarus.
Latvian border guards are legally allowed to use physical force to return irregular migrants to Belarus. In an email, Latvia's state border guard says this has happened only once since August 2022, adding that the use of physical force is a, quote-unquote, last resort. Regional acting border chief Vladimir Scherst insists that border guards only use force when migrants resist removal to Belarus or when they use force themselves. And when pressed, he plays down the dangers resulting from pushing migrants back across the border.
Almost everybody trying to cross the border illegally. Men aged from 18 to 35, 40 years. They're healthy, they are strong. They doesn't need any help from us, like medical assistance. And they are willing to get to Europe by all means.
On my way back to Riga, I stop in the small town of Silin, not far from the border. There, I find two graves, freshly dug. The graves are anonymous. The migrants they belonged to were never identified. Migrant aid groups say they recorded 116 deaths on the EU-Belarusian border over the past 3 years. The real number is likely a lot higher. The Latvian government justifies pushing migrants back across the border with Belarus with security concerns. Latvia and other EU countries have repeatedly accused Belarus of encouraging and facilitating migration, calling it a hybrid attack. Back in Riga, I visit the office of I Want to Help Refugees, which grew out of a Facebook group in 2015. When asked about rhetoric like hybrid attack and denying migrants the chance to claim asylum, border monitoring expert Anna Grieke says both of it is disproportionate.
Of course, there has been some kind of boosting of activity by Belarusian authorities, but it was in the very beginning. Now it's an average road people are taking. It's there for stay and it's definitely not an attack. The number of people arriving and the capacity to accept people to deal with asylum cases, we are more than ready to do that.
The UN Refugee Agency also says effective border management is possible while allowing migrants to seek asylum. I Want to Help Refugees says it has migrants' testimonies of physical and emotional violence and illegal pushbacks. It also claims that several migrants died or had their limbs amputated as a result of being forcibly returned to Belarus. To Grieke, a lack of scrutiny and transparency makes accountability all but impossible.
It's very bad, not only pushbacks, but also the use of physical force and different means to do so are allowed. They can beat, use electroshock, use dogs, and this is all legal. But you are denying, I'm more than persuaded, that not all state border guard is in favor of pushbacks, is in favor to use the force. But since it's so untransparent, there are no truly empowered bodies to supervise the actions of state border guard.
Migrants started to arrive in large numbers from Belarus on the borders with Latvia, Lithuania and Poland in August 2021. All three states then declared states of emergency and introduced pushback laws. Latvia's border guard says its personnel intercepted and forcibly returned more than 5,000 migrants from Latvia to Belarus last year alone. Back in Berlin, I meet up with the Afghan refugee I met on the soccer field in Muciniecki. He's made it to Germany, but the authorities recently told him that he needs to return to Latvia because that is where he was first registered.
What will be the next step of the European Union? If they send me back to Afghanistan, to Latvia, I have hope to live in here and follow my dreams.
He's contemplating seeking church asylum, but fears that the future is bleak.
Reporter Ben Badke in Muciniecki, Latvia, for our partner Deutsche Welle, DW. Formula One, F1, it's all about cars, drivers, and speed. High-performance F1s can top 200 miles an hour. This is what it sounded like at the Belgian Grand Prix in 1998, when the Formula One team owned by Irish entrepreneur Eddie Jordan got its first big victory.
Eddie Jordan, at last, after all his efforts, after fighting his way up.
Eddie Jordan died today at the age of 76. The racing world is mourning his loss. In the 1970s, Eddie Jordan was a bank teller and an accountant in Dublin when he caught the racing bug. He got his start driving go-karts, moving up to more powerful cars in Formula 4 and Formula 3 racing. But his real success came not as a driver, but as an owner. He looked back on his career in this documentary made by Formula One Racing.
I had the dream and I had the belief that I could make it in Formula One and I could make a team.
And what a team Eddie Jordan made. He launched the careers of world champion drivers such as Damon Hill and Michael Schumacher. The former Jordan team driver Martin Brundle spoke today with Sky News.
Eddie gave us a chance and then promoted us like crazy to get us Formula One seats. And I was lucky enough to drive for him for the Jordan team.
Eddie Jordan was a hands-on owner. He supervised the design of his cars, their engines, and was always keeping an eye out for young talent.
We were a kind of a rock and roll team. We were new kids on the block. We were scoring points, and it was fun.
After decades in racing, Jordan turned to broadcasting and a successful run as a sports analyst for the BBC. He even performed with the BBC Concert Orchestra behind a set of drums in this rendition of the Formula One theme. For many racing fans, Eddie Jordan was Formula One. A family statement today said Eddie Jordan passed away peacefully with family by his side in Cape Town, his home in South Africa. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The truce between Israel and Hamas is now over. Israeli ground troops have re-entered the Gaza Strip, and airstrikes have been ongoing for the past few days. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, according to Gaza health officials. Hamas has responded by firing rockets at Tel Aviv. We asked Khaled El-Gindi to describe the return to fighting. He's a visiting scholar at Georgetown University.
We sort of run out of adjectives to describe the situation. I mean, it was already catastrophic, the humanitarian situation. Gaza's been virtually annihilated. And of course, because Israel has stopped allowing any humanitarian aid since the beginning of this month, you have now also a very, very dire food crisis and disease. And now people are once again, hundreds of thousands are being displaced yet again. It's a truly, truly awful situation. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight.
Is it clear to you what the aim of the Israeli military is here?
No. I mean, the stated aim, of course, has always been the total destruction of Hamas, its surrender and the release of the hostages. That was never really an achievable goal. And clearly, we now see after 16 months of total devastation, they haven't been able to destroy Hamas. And in fact, Hamas has reconstituted more or less its fighting force up to now 25 or 30,000 men, just about where they were before October 7th of 2023. And on the hostages, we've seen the only way that hostages, Israeli hostages, come home safely is through diplomacy. What is the end game? It's not the release of hostages, that's for sure. It may be much more in line with what Donald Trump and the Israeli leadership have said, and that is the expulsion of the population. And I think things are moving in that direction.
The White House has an envoy working on this, Steve Witkoff. What is the current U.S. engagement on what's happening?
Before the ceasefire collapse, the Trump administration's position was to try and renegotiate the terms of the deal that had already been agreed by extending phase one, essentially canceling phase two, putting Hamas in the position where they would have to release hostages that they would have released in phase two, but without any of the reciprocal Israeli actions like a permanent ceasefire or withdrawing from Gaza. So that was not an attractive deal for Hamas, but that's what the Americans and Israelis were pushing. And that's why the ceasefire collapsed.
In terms of leadership in Gaza, I mean, I know the Palestinian Authority is the political entity in the West Bank, but do they have any role in Gaza? Are they engaged at all?
They're engaged in a very superficial, cosmetic way. They issue statements, they make pronouncements, but they don't have a presence on the ground, and they're quite unpopular inside Gaza, and for that matter, in the West Bank. The leadership of Mahmoud Abbas is hugely unpopular, in large part because he's seen as totally impotent.
So how far do you see the Israeli war cabinet going? Are ground troops, again, into Gaza just a first, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, it certainly looks that way. I mean, the scale of this latest assault is so massive. And from what we hear from the Israeli leadership, and in particular the Israeli defense minister, just yesterday issued a really disturbing and ominous warning, not to Hamas, but to the entire civilian population of Gaza, that if Hamas doesn't release the hostages and surrender, basically, that they will pay the price. And the price, in his words, was total destruction. And so this is a very clear threat to the civilian population. All of the pretense of trying to limit civilian casualties or regret over all of that is now gone. This is really a moment of truth for the international community. If they genuinely believe in something called a rules-based order and international law, they will have to intervene, because it is this sense of total impunity that has allowed Israel to kill as many civilians as they have and to basically destroy Gaza almost in its entirety.
Since this current war in Gaza began in October of 2023, negotiations with officials from Israel, Hamas, the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar, they've continued. What's happening with those talks now as Israel restarts its ground war?
The only way it's going to end is through a U.S. intervention, and that will require Arab states like the Saudis and the Egyptians and others to weigh in very strongly with the Trump administration and demand that they put an end to it. Otherwise, the plan that they oppose of depopulating Gaza very well could be the outcome. And that's something Arab states would desperately want to avoid. So there's a gap there between the Arab states and the Trump administration. But at the end of the day, Trump understands that if he has any hope, he still wants a normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And that's not going to happen under these circumstances. It will only happen if the U.S. can constrain Israel and stop the killing in Gaza.
Khaled El-Gindi is a visiting scholar at Georgetown University and the former director of the Middle East Institute's program on Palestine and Israeli-Palestinian affairs. The annual World Happiness Report was released today, and the country at the top of the list, drum roll, please, for the 8th year in a row, Finland. Meanwhile, the United States comes in at number 24, its lowest position ever. According to the report, belief in the kindness of others plays an important role. That can be measured by survey questions such as, if you lost your wallet, do you believe others will return it to you? Researchers say people tend to be pretty pessimistic on this question because the actual rate of returned wallets is about twice as high as people expect. Be positive, people. Turning our sights now to southern Africa, Namibia is gearing up for a big day tomorrow. It's Independence Day there, and a new president is being sworn in. Netumbo Nditwa will be Namibia's first woman president and only the second female head of state on the continent. The fact that she is a woman was not actually discussed a whole lot on the campaign trail, but her focus on creating opportunity struck a nerve with women in particular. Reporter Vitalio Angola brings us a story from Namibia's capital.
Earlier this week, I went to the outdoor market in the city of Windhoek, where vendors, mostly women, set up stalls under a bridge right outside a big mall. They are informal traders trying to scrounge up a business in one of the few legal ways available to them. A food vendor in an apron was preparing a big bowl of potato salad. Her name is Albertina Nakale. When I asked her what she thinks about seeing a woman assume the highest office in the land, she said that she hoped that Nandi Ndaitwa will be a nurturing matriarch.
There are so many people there in the street without a job. People are suffering. They should create employment. I don't know how they can do it, but they can do it.
Despite its middle income status, Namibia is ranked as the second most unequal country in the world. That's according to the World Bank, which ranks the country right after its neighbor, South Africa, when it comes to income disparity. Poverty and unemployment disproportionately affect women in Namibia, and many of them think a woman in the presidency might address these issues. Hairdresser Astaria Nandaro makes a living plaiting hair in the market. She wants to upscale her business and maybe get a shop in the mall someday. She has high hopes.
At least she must create a new business opportunity for the young ones and everyone just to have something.
There's a reason these vendors, earning meager profits, think Ndaitwa will help them. The incoming president is not far removed from the lived realities of many Namibians. She doesn't talk much about her past, but as a teenager, she was an activist in the liberation movement here in Namibia, which was then under South African apartheid rule. She got a reputation for being a troublemaker and joined a mass exodus from Namibia in 1973. She came back in 1989 to take part in the first elections in Namibia where black people were allowed to vote, and she's been involved in politics ever since. Now Ndaitwa is 72 years old. She was elected with 58% of the vote, beating 15 male candidates, and she ran her successful presidential campaign on the promise of wider access to markets through the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, or AFTA. It calls for tariff-free trade between African countries that are members. She sees it as a way to address challenges like the high unemployment rate in Namibia, which stands at 36.9%, according to the country's statistics agency. It's even higher than that for women. When I spoke with Ndaitwa on the campaign trail, she told me this is an issue not just for Namibia, but for Africa as a continent.
African young people are put out of the continent to go to other continents and risking their lives. And for me, I don't blame these young people because basically they are following their job.
Until inter-African trade gets serious, she told me, Namibia will be what she calls a rich country with poor people.
And that is what I really don't want to see in Namibia. I don't want to see it in Africa.
Political analyst Rachel Andreas says Ndaitwa's credentials as a freedom fighter and her track record as a minister give her insight into the challenges Namibian women face on a daily basis. Andreas wants Namibia to give her a chance to be effective.
Let's wait for her first 90 days in office before we start trying to pick her apart and try and find fault. If we don't support her within the country, how do we expect the rest of the world to respect her as a competent leader?
Back at the market, the food vendor I spoke with is excited. She told me that men have had plenty of time to run the country, and it's time to give a woman a chance. For the world, I'm Vitalio Angula, Windhoek, Namibia.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is the largest country in sub-Saharan Africa with vast natural resources. And in recent months, the DRC has seen a militia group called the M23 seize a huge amount of territory in eastern DRC.
The situation remains tense in the eastern parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo after M23 rebels pulled out.
Rebels in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, fighting for more than a decade, have captured more of some of the richest land on
Democratic
Earth.
Democratic Republic of Congo President Felix Tshisekedi and his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame have called for a ceasefire in eastern Congo.
There's a lot going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We wanted to get the latest picture of where things stand. Lad Sirwat is a senior analyst with the NGO Armed Conflict Location and Event Data. He joins us from Burundi, which borders the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lad, let's start with the rebel group M23. Who are they exactly, and what do they want?
The M23 are a rebel group that really originated with a failed integration of former militants into the Congolese military. The name March 23 comes from the failed negotiation process of this former militia into the Congolese army on the 23rd of March 2009. And we've seen this group receive quite a lot of backing from Rwanda and have expanded into North and South Kivu as of late.
So as M23 has advanced in recent months, the fighting in eastern Congo has killed an estimated 7,000 people. I know they had seized the major city of Goma earlier this year. Does the territory they've taken include mining assets?
Yeah, a number of the areas that they've captured do include strategic assets, things like gold or tin, as well as coltan. But the specific minerals do vary in their location, and I think those can sort of be lumped in together as if they're all concentrated in one place, but that's simply not the case. For much of the M23's operations, they were in areas that were sort of a bit far from some of the strategic minerals that many people talk about, like coltan or cobalt.
Yeah, just remind us why there's such a global interest in these rare earth minerals.
Many of these minerals are quite important to technology. I mean, everything from things like laptops or phones to lithium batteries are using these minerals that are rare, and Eastern DRC does have kind of a concentration of these minerals.
M23 is the current rebel group, but there's been fighting in eastern Congo for decades. Has this conflict, has the fighting always been about access to minerals?
I think it's important to recognize that there's a number of other drivers outside of these critical minerals. For groups like the M23, they've long been interested in political power in the eastern parts of the country and recently expressed even regime change in Kinshasa. They've expressed kind of long-standing grievances over land and territorial control, as well as the international relations of the region. Rwanda's interests in eastern DRC all play a role in the formation and the continuation of groups like M23 and others.
Well, you mentioned the neighbors. There is the Rwanda factor. Why is Rwanda supporting M23 rebels invading a sovereign country?
Rwanda's interests really come from some grievances that Rwanda had against the DRC, because Congo had formed these strategic military relationships with Uganda. They formed bilateral partnerships with Burundi, both Uganda and Burundi deploying troops into DRC to handle various security threats. We also saw kind of closer economic ties with DRC, with Uganda and Burundi, with Rwanda being left out of it.
The president of the DRC, Felix Tshisekedi, reached out to President Trump recently about a minerals deal. What's that all about?
The way that the Congolese government has dealt with the M23 rebellion has been to look for a number of partnerships. They've done that through their bilateral arrangements with Burundi, through the East African Community, and through different mercenary groups. But many of those have sort of failed to contain the M23 rebellion. So most recently, President Tshisekedi has reached out to the United States in a deal that is quite similar to what we saw in Ukraine, exchanging military support for critical mineral deals in eastern parts of the country. So we don't have any evidence that that has taken place yet. If it does occur, the most likely way that that would take shape is through U.S. support, through equipment, training. We would unlikely see U.S. soldiers, on the ground or something.
Well, as you know, there have been various efforts to end this conflict. Angola has stepped in. At the same time, Rwanda has cut off ties with Belgium over its push to get the EU to sanction Rwanda for supporting M23. So where do efforts to mediate an end to the violence stand right now?
So at the moment, we just saw the Qatari-led efforts to facilitate talks lead to peace agreements between Rwanda and the DRC. In the past, these peace agreements between the DRC and Rwanda have actually led to a significant decline in the levels of monthly political violence involving the M23. It's also led to a very sharp decline of direct Rwandan military involvement in the DRC. The challenge with these ceasefire and peace agreements is that they often don't include the M23, and they also don't include the numerous militias that have been allied and working alongside the Congolese military. So while these peace agreements have held and reduced levels of violence, they have yet to stop the violence that's occurring between the M23 and other militants in the eastern parts of DRC. Eventually, what that has led to is the resumption of hostilities, as we saw Rwandan military engaging directly again in the end of 2024 and leading to the current situation that we're in now.
Lad Serwat is with the NGO Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, updating us on the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It has been 5 years since the start of the COVID pandemic, and National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek remembers where he was at the time, well into his out-of-Eden walk, taking the shoe leather route through Asia. Salopek shot this video in the forest along the India-Myanmar border in December of 2019. You can hear a chorus of creatures, perhaps warning of his approach. Of course, there was a bigger threat looming. COVID-19 was about to make its first appearance in China. Paul Salopek, thanks for being with us again.
Hey, Mark. It's good to be back again.
So Myanmar in Southeast Asia, it shares a border with China. Take us back to the moment when you were there and realized the scope of this pandemic.
Yeah. So I was, as you mentioned, walking through the rainforests of northern Myanmar. It was very hot. It was steamy. It was partly through wilderness. So I was looking forward to reaching an urban center to kind of take a week or 2 week long break, as I often do on this project. And so I managed to reach the old imperial city of Mandalay in northern Myanmar. And that's when I first start getting the news coming across the wires, as it were, that there's some new exotic virus breaking out all over the world.
So you said on the wires, that were. How did you actually get that news?
Well, probably like most everybody else, on my phone.
Yeah.
So scrolling the news, and, you know, it was mysterious. And I was in a country that I'd never been in before. Moreover, I was in kind of a remote part of the country.
So as Myanmar is going into lockdown, you're walking and interviewing people. Many people were actively trying to help their fellow Burmese. Is there one person at the time whose story stays with you even now?
Yeah. So this is what's so amazing. I'm in northern Myanmar, and, you know, a city of 1.2 million. I've booked a room in a guest house. News comes out about COVID. Everybody leaves. I'm the only person left in a four-story guest house with the staff.
Wow.
And the guy who was managing this guest house was a great guy. His name was Aung Cho Cho, a young guy in his late 20s. He had no public health experience, but he was very public-spirited. So he started organizing himself, his friends, and his staff to try to do emergency work in this city of 1.2 million. So Aung Cho Cho came to me saying, Paul, do you know anything? I was just a foreigner, you know, walking through his city. He said, do you know anything about setting up food banks? Because in a country as poor as Myanmar, the virus, of course, could kill you. Nobody knew how deadly it was. But hunger, if you're immobilized, if you lose your job, if you go into lockdown, hunger will get you first. So he was Googling how to set up food banks, how to prepare hand sanitizer. You know, in rich countries in the global north, people were talking about not enough respirators to go around. In northern Myanmar, it was, we don't even have hand sanitizer. So the local chemistry students at the university were concocting kind of homemade hand sanitizer to give to the people. There were businessmen talking to each other saying, how do we identify on the streets people at risk, migrant workers, homeless people, and delivering food on motor scooters? It was this very dark, scary time, but also really inspiring of how this community mobilized to defend itself against an unknown virus.
So while you were there in Myanmar, this other crisis was looming, a political one that would erupt on February 1st, 2021. The military, as you said, staged a coup. People reacted with protests across the country, like this one. Paul, you've seen a lot of protests in your work as a journalist. You've reported from war zones. You've seen people living in poverty. What from your past experience prepared you for walking through Myanmar while this was happening in 2021?
Well, it was, despite all my past history as a conflict reporter, this was unique because it was a civil war that was erupting before my eyes that was happening on top of a global pandemic. And so everybody's concerns about dying and from COVID quickly evaporated about being shot on the streets. And so it was this double whammy for the poor people of Burma. I think their kind of innocence, as it were, in dealing with both a military crackdown, expecting the world to come rescue them in the middle of a pandemic, was kind of a double heartbreak. It was truly, truly hard to see.
So you left Myanmar for your own safety in 2021, flew to China. China was still trying to manage COVID with strict policies around travel. What was the biggest challenge for you when you restarted your walk in Western China?
It was COVID-19. As you know, China had among the strictest lockdown quarantine rules of any country in the world. Of course, when I entered China from Myanmar, I had to go into a quarantine myself. That was a whole adventure because I had not the capacity to leave the hotel and kind of get all the apps necessary to participate in commerce in China. So I had friends calling the hotel from other countries saying, can you buy this guy a cup of tea? And so when I got out of the quarantine, I was still stuck in the city of Shanghai for months, waiting for Western China to kind of get this magic moment when there were no quarantines, regional, local quarantines, so I could start walking through the country. It took months.
And did you catch COVID at any point?
I finally did get COVID when most other Chinese did. It's when the government abruptly lifted all its restrictions in late 2022 and early 2023. I was walking through the province of Shaanxi. My walking partner was lagging behind. I could tell she wasn't feeling well. Guess what? It was COVID. And then a few days later, I had COVID too.
Wow. And were you then kind of like stuck in place for several days? What did you do at that point?
So we didn't know what to do because just a few days earlier, according to Chinese government regulations, we had to immediately go into COVID quarantine, government regulated kind of holding areas, but they were no longer in existence. Everybody in China was kind of scratching their heads saying, what do we do? We checked into a hotel that normally we would not be able to do. The clerks were very generous, very human. They said, just go into your rooms and lock yourselves into your rooms. And so I spent 9 days in a hotel room on my back. I got a pretty serious attack of the symptoms.
Paul, as someone who has walked many thousands of miles of the globe since 2013, what lasting impact do you see of COVID-19 5 years on?
Well, you know, the biggest one are those 7 million poor souls who are no longer with us.
Yeah.
And then in addition, there are all the millions of people who are suffering through long COVID, whose extended symptoms are still just being explored. But the biggest thing, Marco, even above that, I think, is the fact that the way different countries handled this pandemic somehow broke the public trust, both in really severe, strict conditions, say in China, and in ones that were looser, say in the United States. So if another pandemic comes, I fear that people will no longer listen to sensible medical advice, and it's going to be worse than ever.
You can find pictures and links to stories Paul posted from his journey through Myanmar and China there at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, thank you very much. Good to talk.
Likewise, Marco. Thank you for having me on again.
Make sure to join us tomorrow for the day's top global stories and donuts. We have the story of one Cambodian man's first encounter with American donuts and why he is still known as the Donut King 50 years later. That's tomorrow here on The World. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe to The World wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Glasscock Heritage Trust, Jennifer Woodruff, Cindy Engels, Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman, and Carrie and Nelson Hoffman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.